Welcome to State of the News. I'm Rick Heldick. Well, another Friday, another week gone by, and a lot to talk about in our Metro News segment. And joining us is our cast of regulars from the WFPL newsroom, Gabe Bullard, Philip M. Bailey, Erica Peterson, and Dalton Main. Welcome, everyone.
Good to be here.
Hi.
Happy Friday to you. Let's start with an update on the Ohio River Bridges Project. The Bi-State Authority overseeing the plan to build two new bridges and rework Spaghetti Junction continues to meet. There was an agreement yesterday to set a timetable for seeking certain bids from contractors for the big project, and public comment on the project continues. We'll discuss that in a moment. There's also this ongoing effort to win hearts and minds. There are people, of course, that want one bridge but not the other. Others don't want to use tolls to help pay for them. Others still want to move full steam ahead with the entire project. And Gabe Bullard, you've been following a relatively new campaign for in favor of the entire project. It's fair to say has a bit of a harder edge.
It does. It's an unusual thing. It's this movie called Building Bridges with Benny Breeze. This is really what we've seen, I think, might be the last chapter in the controversy and discussion over this. This is a movie that was meant to promote the Bridges Project. It was commissioned by Indiana businessman Vaughn Scott, who is on the One Southern Indiana board, and he has put up 90% of the money for it. He won't say who has put up the other 10% of the money, but he is he's put up the money. These two Louisville filmmakers have put together a 15-minute movie to promote the project. It's meant to be a comedy. It's meant to appeal to people who would rather, as they say, watch YouTube than read the paper or listen to public radio even, just to get the news. And some people have been calling this propaganda. Some have called it AstroTurf because there is some financing behind this. There are pro-Bridges people behind it, making it look a little more grassroots than it likely is. There are some powerful proponents. Greater Louisville, Inc. linked to some information about the movie on their website. And a lot of the anti-toll groups, people opposed to various parts of the Bridges Project, argue that this video is the wrong approach. We've given this a lot of attention because this movie strikes us as just being so unusual. It's something that's so off the beaten path, and it's an odd tactic given how all the other arguments around the Bridges Project have really been shaped. And so with this movie, people listening have probably heard the reports already that when it was first being made, that there was some humor based on racial stereotypes. And before it premiered, we followed up with Vaughn Scott and with the filmmakers, and they said a lot of the jokes, a lot of the more outrageous jokes, were cut from the movie. And this final 15-minute premiere, 15-minute project, it's basically a monologue in favor of the Bridges Project. It was going to be premiered online after they showed it at two live events in Kentucky and Indiana, but they ended up saying, Vaughn Scott said he wasn't going to release it, that it was only going to be shown live. Now he says it's back by popular demand on YouTube. He's sending out links telling people to watch it. I just checked right before coming down. Fewer than 400 people have watched it, but we have a montage of some of the clips from the movie.
I'm just a mother get done. Have you been on the Kennedy Bridge lately? You got potholes everywhere. You drive underneath, you got concrete falling off, rebar exposed. This shit's getting ridiculous. That's why when I'm crossing the Kennedy Bridge, whether it be getting fireworks, the strip club, going to the casino, I take precautions. But Sherry told me, now Benny, you gotta try them chocolate chip waffles. They are the shit. 96 people will lose their homes because of the East End Bridge being built. Now honestly, if I had time, I'd sit down with all of them. We have a big old shrimp dinner, and I'm busy as f***. They're gonna have to build a tunnel. Now, I haven't heard of any names being thrown out yet, but for conversation's sake, let's just call it the Diane Sawyer Canal. We don't have a NBA team, a NFL team, no sports teams, no nothing. We're stuck in the AAA. Maybe you could put Uncle Elroy back to work. Get JoJo out of the pool hall. If we come together as a community, we're unstoppable. What it boils down to is, you're either for progress, or you against it. If you against it, get the f*** out of this region.
So those were a few clips from this Building Bridges with Benny Breeze movie that has now been released online. It's meant to promote the project. As you said, it's sort of a hearts and minds campaign that has been heavily, heavily criticized.
So what's the reaction been to this?
The biggest reaction I've seen has been from opponents of tolls, these anti-toll groups who have at first were riled up that such a tactic was being used, but have now, I think the last comment I saw was someone called it a snooze fest, because so much had been cut from the movie, admittedly by the filmmakers.
And this is not affiliated with this other group, Kentuckians for Progress. I can imagine Rebecca Jackson saying these things in her presentation.
The only official backing that we know from this movie is Vaughn Scott, who's on the One Southern Indiana board. He's put up this 90% of the money. He says he refuses, he will continue to refuse to say where the other 10% of the money comes from, because he doesn't want them to face the same sort of scrutiny. He has a number of issues with the press, with some of the coverage around this movie, and he essentially has problems with or complaints about how the press has covered the Bridges Project in general, hence this idea to make a movie that would appeal to people otherwise through humor, though a lot of the humor was cut out. What we heard in the montage, it's kind of like a movie trailer for a bad movie. All the parts that are interesting are there.
All right.
Right up front.
No plans for a follow-up that we know of?
No, not at all. And like you'd mentioned, yeah, there are Kentuckians for Progress have not come out in support of this. Other pro-Bridges groups have not.
All right. Well, the public comment, as we mentioned, a public comment period for the updated Ohio River Bridges Project continues this week. The updated plans for the scaled-down project were unveiled at public comment hearings last week, covered by our own Dalton Main. And many of the attendees simply want the bridges built, but differed on how and where they should be built. And we have another montage here. These are some of the folks that Dalton's put together, some of the folks who were there.
Roger Parvin, Assistant Chief of Administration for Louisville Metro EMS.
My name is Stu Nolan. I'm a founder of a democracy activism group named Save Louisville.
Bob Griffith, I'm an attorney representing Riverfields.
Patty Clare, Deputy Director of the Downtown Development Corporation.
David Eugene Blank.
Paul Fetter, co-founder of Organization for Better Southern Indiana and NoToBridgeTolls.org.
Carrie Stemler.
I'm John Sachstetter. I'm the project manager with Community Transportation Solutions, the general engineering consultant for the project. We're trying to get the input of the public of what their thoughts are about our current project design before we start moving on forward.
We're on track. It's a schedule. Now, there are certain things that are in our control and certain things that are out of our control. But as of today, we're on track for August 2012.
Well, I think they need to come away with a real good understanding of, you know, what's happening now with the modified alternative. It's very positive. The project is smaller.
Build the East End Bridge, part of the regional transportation plan for 50 years, as quickly as possible.
Then once they build an East End Bridge, which should be six lanes, they should take a rest for about 3 years and see what kind of impact on traffic.
The Eastern Bridge, on the other hand, solves no traffic problems and no safety problems. And we believe that it is not in the best interest of our community.
We do believe that any tolling mechanism they use to fund the project will turn out unfair for Southern Indiana, and we're hoping to persuade our leaders to try to find a way to complete or fund this project without tolling it.
Let's get the bridges built. It's time for it. We've been talking about this for years now. Let's get them built and get the city rolling.
All right, a montage of public comment on the Ohio River Bridges Project that's collected by Dalton Main. Dalton, is there still a chance or still an opportunity for people to comment publicly?
The public comment period will continue until next Friday, and it's all online. You just go and fill out the online comment form, and we have a link to that on WFPL.org. If you go, that's posted. You can get a link to the online comment form, and you can say whatever you want. It'll go into the register, and they'll review it. So,
all right. Well, we should also note that WFPL will be investigating the environmental impact of the Bridges Project. This is made possible through Story Exchange. You may have heard of us talking about it, in which you help us with the funding of various news stories and bring them to fruition. There's information about that on our website, WFPL.org. Let's go back to you, Dalton Main. You were also present for the new phase of yet another bridge project. This is the Big Four pedestrian bridge over the Ohio.
Uh-huh. When they decided to go ahead and redeck it and make it into a pedestrian walkway, and it will be, they said, the largest overwater pedestrian bridge in the nation when it's completed. And that walk up sure is long. It took a while to get up.
They let you go up it?
Yep. They opened it up for the day, and they welcomed people up there, and they opened the gates and showed people the bridge. It was kind of neat getting to look down it. But they're going to go ahead and start redecking. They, I guess, said they were officially starting construction that day. So they said it'll be completed by 2013. And I know part of it was that they have to get the ramp on the other side, on the Jeffersonville side, finished. And I think that was the longest timetable, was that that would be completed in about 18 months, is what Jeffersonville Mayor Tom Galligan said.
All right. And on another icon of Louisville, something that's local to us, the Louisville clock we've been hearing about over the years, that was created by artist Barney Bright and was once downtown. It's been refurbished, also called the Derby Clock. It may have a new permanent home.
Uh-huh. It used to sit in the 80s, not too far from here, down mm-hmm. on 4th Street, just north of the Galleria, as it was called then. And right now they're trying to get it moved to Theater Square, which is right there as a BBC right there. It's sort of catacorner to the Louisville Palace. And they want to sit it there. They're going to need to make a few adjustments to that area. There's, a stage there right now for where they do live music, and I think they're talking about, you know, pulling that out to make room for this clock. But people are very excited about it. I think all the businesses in the area have said that they are behind it. They would love to have that attraction there. You know, apparently when it used to have the races at noon, a lot of people would come out during lunchtime and watch the races, and it was a pretty enjoyable thing. So it'd be great to see that come down here where there's been such new developments.
This is for those who don't know, this is a racetrack. It's a pretty tall clock, isn't it? It has a racetrack on it and various figures from Louisville's history race around there.
Yeah, it's about 45 feet tall, is what they said. It's sitting at Bowman Field right now, where it's been restored by the owner of the Homemade Ice Cream and Pie Kitchen. Had it moved there in 2004, and he's been coordinating efforts to repaint it, restore it. The statues feature, you know, King Louis the 16th, George Rogers Clark. There's a fictional Belle of Louisville. It's a woman with, you know, paddling mm-hmm. wheel behind her. So it's a neat sort of a unique monument that we have, and it'd be great to see it back out here.
There's a great short film made by Al Shands here in Louisville, who worked for Wave Television back in the day, that of the clock, people going around the clock, the figures going around, and people watching it, including a young Jerry Abramson, who I believe was an alderman back then. That's well worth taking the time to hunt down if you can. KET shows them from time to time. But anyway, following up with you, Dalton, a couple of economic development announcements, hiring on at Ford for all these new jobs.
Yeah, the plant that's going to build the new Ford Escape was recently retooled, and it is going to be, they're going to be hiring 1,800 new workers. Some of those workers will be people who were displaced or laid off before, when the plant scaled back its production for the $600 million retooling. But they're going to have a mix of new and former workers. But it's 1,800 new jobs that weren't there, you know, before. So GLI took a lot of the credit for that, saying that they persuaded Ford to stay in the area, to invest in the plant, and to retool it. Otherwise, it would have closed, and there would have been no jobs. So, you know, it's good to at least get those 1,800 back.
Not as many jobs created here, per se. Just a few, actually, at first, but they're still significant nonetheless. We're getting a new distillery in downtown Louisville.
Mm-hmm. Michter's, which I believe originated in Shaferstown, Pennsylvania, but is New York-based now. Mm-hmm. It claims to be the oldest or the first commercial whiskey distiller in the nation. Supposedly, this Michter's is what George Washington served to his troops at Valley Forge. So they have a rich history, and they were very excited to announce that they will be putting in a small production facility in the old Fort Nelson building, which is right in between 21C and the Fraser Historical mm-hmm. Arms Museum. Or the Fraser History Museum, sorry, down on Main Street. I believe it's at 8th and Main is where the building is. So it's going to be a small batch and single barrel rye whiskey and bourbon producing facility. I believe they're already bottled in Bardstown. So it's a good addition to the area. Mayor Fisher was really excited to announce, you know, that it would be, you know, coming into the Urban Bourbon Trail. And we, of course, sit at the head of the Kentucky Bourbon Trail. So
he tried to get you over to the tasting, and you wisely, because we had something else to do.
Unfortunately.
Came back to the station. Well, glad you took one for the team. All right, thanks a lot, Dalton Main. Let's turn to Philip M. Bailey. And, Philip, another chapter this week in the saga of Metro Councilwoman Judy Green.
Yeah, the Metro Ethics Commission came back with its second decision in regards to Councilwoman Green. Two complaints, obviously, were filed against her. This one was dealing with the charge that she had broken council rules by rerouting funds through 100 Black Men of Louisville to other organizations that weren't listed on the original application, including her church and an event for a Kentucky Derby festival that she attended. The Ethics Commission came back with a similar ruling that it did in the first case, that Councilwoman Green broke the ethics law, that she had misled council members because she lobbied for the funds and passed the had it passed in the Appropriations Committee. Councilman Green, as before, maintains her innocence. She blamed, as she did in the ethics hearing, the infraction on her former legislative aide, saying that the shoddy paperwork was really her fault at the end of the day. But the commission has also issued the letter of reprimand and censure, which makes history. This is the first time an elected official in metro government has gotten a public rebuke of that kind from the Ethics Commission. The commission decided not to forego a recommendation that she be removed from the council, saying at this point it's a moot point, considering that they already recommended that in the first ethics charge, and that the council is moving forward on her removal.
So that no date has been set for this trial-like proceeding as of yet.
At this point, we're looking at early August. Greg Hovius, who is the legal counsel for the five members of the council who impeached Councilman Green, he said that he expects this trial to be sometime in probably the first week or second week of August. It'll last 2 or 3 days. You'll see a number of witnesses, including witnesses not just associated with the ethics charge, but a number of other allegations made against Councilman Green by her current and former legislative aides, including allegations of bribery, of forging of signatures. One of her current aide, Andrea Jackson, who told police that a $25,000 credit card was taken out in her name without her knowledge. So these things could come forward, particularly as Councilman Green makes the point that her character is being attacked and that she represents someone who's doing great things in the community. So Hovius has said that that could come up, that those witnesses have been subpoenaed, including her former legislative aide, Melody Hill, who told police last year that Councilman Green told her that she did take some money from a liquor store owner in West Louisville. Councilman Green has denied that, although she's never been formally interviewed by police or anyone else in regards to that charge. So it won't just be a rehash of the ethics hearing charges that we saw a few months ago. This removal trial could get into a whole number of different allegations.
And Judy Green's radio show debuts tomorrow, right?
Yes. The debut of Something to Talk About, which will air on WLOU 1350 AM on Saturday at 4. That's the councilman's show. It'll be a 30-minute program. Many people are wondering what the program actually will be, whether it will be her addressing her ongoing ethics troubles and her removal trial. The programming director of WLOU says that won't happen, but there's a chance, given Councilman Green's outspokenness to other media outlets where she has called out other council members by name, that the show could entail the airing of all of that publicly.
And quickly, we had some news from Metro Animal Services this week, some overcrowding and a big adoption blitz.
Yeah, you had the city ask for on Tuesday for anyone who looking for a special rate to adopt dogs. This was a result of the two additional distemper cases that were found in dogs at the Manslick shelter. There were, due to the fact that the original dog who had distemper wasn't properly quarantined, nor was the dog properly vaccinated in the first place, which is against policy and procedures of the department. Interim Director Susan Neumeyer said that was a mistake, that those staff members have been disciplined. But I guess it adds more fuel to the fire and draws more attention to LMAS, as Mayor Fisher, I think, has inherited the troubled agency, and more observers and animal welfare advocates are chiming in and I guess criticizing his handling of the department. The mayor's office, however, says this was a success, that you had those animals were adopted at the end of the day at that special rate. I think it was a $9 adoption rate that day. And that overall, there are some improvements being made as far as communication and streamlining of services. However, there's still the question of when the city moves to pick a new director, that will be the candidates who initially were in a pool that the city wasn't satisfied with back in March. So this will continue. I think the mayor's Facebook page is still being bombarded with criticisms over his handling of the department.
All right. Thank you very much, Philip. You're listening to State of the News on WFPL, and we're talking with the WFPL news staff covering Metro News. And we now turn to environmental reporter Erica Peterson, who's with us. Erica, you've been reporting this week on the EPA finalizing air pollution rules for power plants. What's going on there?
Well, Rick, this is something that's been in the works for a while, and it's not something that is going to affect power plants in Kentucky immediately. Power plants in Kentucky have been under this other rule that was vacated by the courts a couple years ago for being too lenient, and the courts basically told the EPA that they needed to come up with something else. So that's been in place, and it will be in place until it's replaced by this rule on January 1st. But the idea behind the rule is that States pollute, and air pollution crosses state lines, and some states are dealing with pollution from other states and can't do anything about it. So this is basically making certain states reduce the amount of noxious air pollution they're producing.
Now, we have, of course, a big utility company here, Louisville Gas and Electric, and the Kentucky Utilities throughout Kentucky. What are they saying about this?
Well, they have they announced in May that they were seeking a rate increase for some environmental upgrades, and this is not the main factor in that. There's another rule that's expected by the end of the month that's supposed to be more expensive to comply with, but this is part of that. They've accounted for it. They're going to have to reduce their emissions by 2014 is the first step, and they've said that they're willing to do that as long as they get their costs recouped.
Speaking of air quality, if you're in any Louisville neighborhood last weekend, probably your neighborhood was a little smokier than usual and also littered with fireworks debris. You've been looking into what kind of effect the letting off of all these fireworks had on our air quality.
Yeah, there were a ton of fireworks that were set off. Besides the city's official celebrations in the streets on both Sunday and Monday. And we've been seeing some air quality problems in the area lately for ozone. And the fireworks contribute to a different kind of air pollution called particle pollution. And basically, all the fireworks set off the particle pollution. There are four monitors in the Louisville area, and they all reported higher than normal levels, especially on Sunday. It was especially worse. But pretty much the EPA will monitor the readings that we get here. And if there's a certain number of readings that exceed the air quality standards, we can be fined for that. So we haven't, the city, Matt Stoll with the city says they haven't decided yet whether they're going to apply for an exceptional event, which basically means this is not regular polluting. This is something that really never happens. I think cultural celebration is actually one of the categories, mm-hmm. specifically for fireworks. So they could always apply for that to basically get that stricken from the record.
All right, Erica Peterson, WFPL environmental reporter. Thank you. We have a couple of minutes left in our Metro segment. Gabe, I want to turn to you. The space shuttle, the last flight of the space mm-hmm. shuttle, last liftoff was this morning. And once again, the organization Kentucky Space with an experiment on board.
Yeah, the Kentucky Space has sent a number of experiments up to the International Space Station, and a number of those with manned flights, which are coming to at least a temporary end for the American space program today with the final mission of the shuttle program. What's on the payload this time, coming from Kentucky Space, is part of this wider health initiative to test how certain malignant cells or diseases behave in microgravity in space. So there's glioblastoma cells, which is a type of malignant brain cancer. Those cells, Kentucky Space has put them into this project for observation. They have been blasted off. They're on board the shuttle, and they'll observe how those cells behave in microgravity to see if there's any sort of transformation or anything that could possibly be used for a cure here on Earth in regular gravity.
As Chris Kimmel, the executive director, is mm-hmm. looking beyond the shuttle program or what else they can be doing?
He is. He says that there's really no replacement for people in space, that the greatest machine you can put into space to adapt and to think and to act is the human brain. But as far as experiments that Kentucky Space will be launching, they're not slowing down. They're still going to be sending them up with some of these unmanned vehicles that go to the space station, orbiters, private enterprise now. They've already begun work. Kentucky Space has begun working with this company, SpaceX, that does a lot of research in space. It's a private company. They're also working with other nation space programs to launch unmanned vehicles up into space. And he predicts that within a couple of years, people will be back into space and helping with these experiments as well.
All right. Thanks, Gabe. We're not going to have time to discuss it. I did want to mention that Dr. Donna Hargens, the new Jefferson County school superintendent, is in town for about a week or so. Got a chance to talk to her yesterday, and she will be formally introduced at Monday's board meeting. Well, I believe the board is going to approve her contract. But I hope to have her on this program or mm-hmm. on this time slot here in the coming weeks, Dr. Donna Hargens. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, John Murray of the Indianapolis Star joins us to talk about a criminal case in the Hoosier State that's drawing national attention and generated a lot of activity on social networks. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. On May 31st, Tyel Morton decided to pull a prank on the last day of classes at Rushville Consolidated High School in Indiana. He placed a blow-up doll in a girl's bathroom, but authorities, using an eyewitness account and abundance of caution apparently, assumed that something much more dangerous was going on and acted accordingly. Now Tyel Morton is facing some very serious charges. John Murray is city county government reporter for the Indianapolis Star and has been covering this case, and he joins us now. Welcome to the program, John.
Hey, thanks, Rick.
So young Mr. Morton puts the, this is a blow-up sex doll, for lack of a better term.
Right.
Puts it in the girl's bathroom, but a janitor sees him leaving and is suspicious that something else may be going on, right?
Yeah, and that's kind of the I guess for lack of a better word, tragedy, comma tragedy of how that happened. Is nobody really realized that it was a doll. All they know at the beginning is that, you know, somebody who's wearing a sweatshirt with a hood that conceals his face and latex gloves is seen, you know, going in the building and 5 minutes later leaving the building. They don't know what he did in the middle there until much later, which obviously turns out to be innocuous. So they sort of jumped to conclusions and thought, well, he may be planted some explosives or something like that.
Being cautious in this hasn't been that long since the Columbine massacre and other school shootings and that sort of thing.
Sure. So yeah, and that seems to really be coloring the school's response. And then they called in state police and local police, and a bomb squad came and scoured the school. Everybody was locked down in the gym for 3 hours while this was going on.
And he was a juvenile at the time, right?
Well, you know, he was 18 years old. He was a graduating senior, so he is being treated as an adult.
Oh, I see.
He is legally an adult.
Well, what charges is he facing?
The charges are, there's a felony under Indiana law. It's a C felony called institutional criminal mischief. And then there's just a misdemeanor disorderly conduct charge, and it's that criminal mischief charge that has a potential penalty of 2 to 8 years in prison.
And he spent several days in jail, didn't he?
Yeah, he spent. He was arrested the same day, and you know, readily admitted to what he did. Didn't lie about it. Spent 5 days in jail until his family could post the $30,000 bond by raising 10% of that.
What kind of penalties would he be looking at for these offenses?
Well, realistically, you can't really find anybody, including the prosecutor who's prosecuting this case, who really is going to push. He says, I'm not going to push for a prison sentence. But, I mean, under the law, that statute that he's charged with is 2 to 8 years in prison. But again, the prosecutor says he's probably not going to go for any prison time because nobody was actually harmed in this.
And this is a young man who hasn't been in trouble before.
Yeah, no, he's got a clean record. He's by all accounts, a good student, an honor student.
But he would, it's conceivable that he could have a felony on his record.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I think that's the biggest threat hanging out there is that he's going to, after all is said and done, you know, he could conceivably end up with a felony for this.
And prosecutors aren't showing any willingness to possibly amend the charges?
No, and for my story, which ran in the paper this week, the prosecutor was not available last week, but he did affirm to the, I believe the Associated Press spoke with him this week, and his name is Phil Cavanis, the prosecutor. And he affirmed that he thinks that he charged the case appropriately and did not back it. But he didn't second guess that.
Now, what kind of reaction? There's been quite a bit of reaction from this, correct?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's within Rushville itself. It's a town of about 6,000 people, and it's about an hour southeast of Indianapolis. You're hard pressed to find anybody who thinks that the response to this is necessarily appropriate. There's a whole lot of overreach being talked about. And this isn't really so much being talked about in the town, but certainly the question has been raised outside of Rushville, you know, the suspect's race. Tyel Morton, he is African-American. And this is a town that's 95% white. So they are wondering, you know, is this another black kid from a poor family who's being mistreated by the justice system? And again, even Tyel's family members are not necessarily pursuing that line of thought. They said, well, let's focus on just the you know, overreaction by school and police here without bringing race into it.
And this drew a column by Leonard Pitts down in Miami, right?
Yeah, he wrote his nationally syndicated column about this about 2 weeks ago.
What are his thoughts about it?
He focused more on the race angle and compared this case to a case in Florida in which a white young man who's an adult, a young adult, he killed a couple people while driving his car drunk, if I recall correctly. That case is done now, and that gentleman has ended up with essentially house arrest and says, well, look at that case, and then look at this case in Indiana where this kid's potentially facing, you know, prison for something that certainly is much less serious than killing two people with your car.
And is there an effort to, I don't know what kind of financial situation the family is in, is there a grassroots effort to help him with his case financially?
There is. I mean, the family's not wealthy. It's a fairly kind of blue-collar, middle-class town. There were quite a few donations that came in to help the family make bail. They had to raise about $3,000, and so that's why it took 5 days to get him out of jail. And I think $2,000 of that came from a single donor, and there's some other donations. They're also collecting some money for his defense fund because they have an attorney from Indianapolis that they hired. And so there's a website called freetyellmorton.org, and Tyell is spelled T-Y-E-L-L. That seems to be kind of the central organizing point for a lot of folks, from most of them not from Indiana, actually. There's just a lot of people who are mad about this case and have made the effort to organize some opposition to it and write letters to the editor of the local paper and lobby the prosecutor and school there to do what they think would be commonsensical.
And then he was a senior in high school. That was his last day of school.
Yeah, it was the very last day of school, and he... you know, he got out of jail actually on what turned out to be graduation day. He had been told prior that he would not be allowed to participate in graduation ceremonies. But as far as I know at this point, his family's understanding is that he will be receiving his diploma.
I see. So what's next in his court case?
His court case, he has a trial set in mid-September. And between now and then, it seems like from talking to his defense attorney, there's going to be, I would assume, a legal challenge of the basis of these charges. Some legal experts I spoke with questioned whether the statute that's being relied on here for that felony charge is really being used properly, since there was no physical damage caused to the school at all, which is a basis for that charge. So his attorney is, I think, pursuing that line of thinking as well, and will, I would expect that he'll probably file a motion to dismiss the charges or use that as a negotiating tool with the prosecutor.
All right. Well, I got you here. Let's ask you about a couple of other stories you've been covering. I've written about Indiana's immigration law, some of which was struck down by a federal judge recently.
Yes. Yeah, that was about 2 weeks ago today. There was actually twin rulings. Indiana's legislature passed a Planned Parenthood defunding law on abortion, and as well as a immigration law that does not go as far as the Arizona law as far as restricting illegal immigration and things like that, but it still did a few things that were found to run afoul of federal law by a federal judge, and so she struck down those provisions 2 weeks ago.
And one of those had to do with an ID that you use?
Yeah, what it did is there are ID cards that foreign consulates will issue to their foreign nationals who are living in the United States, and these are ID cards that banks will generally accept as form of identification and some other businesses will use. It varies as though as far as state and local governments. Most of them don't readily accept these things. And what this law attempted to do was to say that these foreign issue ID cards could not be used not just by the state and local governments, but really by any business in Indiana as a valid form of identification. And the judge found that was unconstitutional.
Any indication that the state will appeal?
They seem pretty intent on appealing. There's an interesting dynamic there because the attorney general, who's an elected official as well, he's a Republican. He's the same party as the majority in the legislature that passed this law, but there's a difference of opinion on it. He came out vocally during the debate when there were quite a few more serious provisions being proposed, more like Arizona's. And he came out among some business leaders and said, you know, really this is a federal issue, so I would urge the legislature not to be taking this up. But it is something that the legislature passed, that the governor signed, and it's his duty kind of as the attorney general to defend it. So he is, said he will defend it in court.
And you've also been covering the plans for a September 11th memorial in Indianapolis.
Correct.
What's this about? Who's behind it?
There's a kind of enterprising firefighter here in town named Greg Hess, who was among a couple of dozen folks from Indianapolis, first responders who went down to New York right after 9/11 and the days after, and spent a good week or two on the pile helping first search for survivors and then to recover bodies. And he is raising money to build a memorial on Indianapolis's downtown canal area, and they petitioned the Port Authority in New York, New Jersey, and were able to obtain a couple months ago a couple of 22-foot-long steel beams that were used as internal support beams in one of the towers that had been preserved at Kennedy Airport in a hangar there. And this is wreckage that's being made available across the country to memorials like this that localities are putting up. And so there's going to be a memorial that incorporates these beams kind of standing in for the Twin Towers to represent those. And I think there's an American Eagle that'll be part of it, and as well as some inscriptions memorializing that day.
Is there a groundbreaking scheduled?
They're hoping to do groundbreaking on September 11th. And actually was by the site the other day, and they have not they're hoping to dedicate it by September 11th. So I think the groundbreaking they're hoping to do later this month to get that underway, because they really are intent on having it ready and ready to have a dedication on September 11th and the 10th anniversary.
And you say this is going to be at the canal area of Indy?
Yeah, it's on the west and southwest part of downtown.
My point of reference in Indianapolis is the big monument, so mm-hmm. I have to use that as my center. So.
Sure, it's about three or four blocks due west of Monument Circle, which is kind of the center of downtown.
All right, well, John Murray, thanks so much for joining us and being on the program. Hope to have you back soon, and good luck to you up in Indianapolis.
Oh, thanks, my pleasure.
John Murray of the Indianapolis Star, and when we come back, we'll check in with the Courier-Journal's Eric Crawford, who's covering the NASCAR Sprint Cup races at the Kentucky Speedway in northern Kentucky. This is State of the News on WFPL. Welcome back to State of the News. I'm Rick Howlett. For the better part of the last decade, officials from Kentucky's private and public sectors have been trying to lure the Sprint Cup series of races to the Kentucky Speedway in Sparta in northern Kentucky. The Sprint Cup is the top racing series of NASCAR. Stock car racing. Well, that wish is now a reality as Sprint Cup races are being held this weekend at the track. And joining us to talk about Sprint Cup, NASCAR, and the Kentucky Speedway is Courier-Journal sports columnist Eric Crawford. Hi, Eric.
Hey, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you today?
I'm doing good.
And you're at the track? You're at the media center?
Well, no, actually I'm not. I'm working on more of a scene setter pace. And at the moment, you'll like this. I'm at the last truck stop before entering the
okay.
Speedway, where basically a little NASCAR village has sprung up. It's kind of like a NASCAR flea market, kind of impromptu. There are tents lining this truck stop, and there's live music in a tent across the way, and kind of an interesting scene. I mean, you pass this truck stop 364 days a year on the interstate, and nothing's going on, and it's kind of become a little village here, so I'm just stopped here to kind of talk to people about the race and things like that. But it's just kind of part and parcel of kind of what goes along with these events like this.
Well, this is a huge crowd. I would guess the biggest ever at the Kentucky Speedway, right?
Well, yeah, they've drawn very well. I think they've had crowds of 70,000 for some lower-tier events, but they've sold, 107,000 tickets for this, and obviously I guess they can accommodate a few more people too, so... all the seats are sold, but I think they're still selling standing room and some other types of tickets.
How is the area handling up there, the traffic and so forth?
Well, it's not really, we haven't seen it yet, because the traffic probably won't become an issue till tonight when there's NASCAR, the Sprint Cup qualifying and the Nationwide Series race. So I would imagine in a couple hours traffic would start to hit, and we're going to see the traffic and parking capacity of this place really tested, and it's going to be a legitimate test because it's wet, and you've got parking going on in the grass. In fact, this little flea market thing is basically in the mud because they've been having some rain up here. So it's going to be a challenge, and there are going to be some growing pains with this, I think, as anything is. But fans of this sport are used to waiting. You know, they're used to taking 2 or 3 hours to get in and out, and that's just how it is.
Are the drivers happy? I heard I saw you had a piece today that some of the drivers were talking about the track being a little rough.
Yeah, and they say it's the roughest track that they will compete on all year, which when you think about it is a little bit funny. I wouldn't say most of them are complaining about it. A few of them are complaining, but, you know, the origins of the sport were in running moonshine away from the law enforcement. So their roots are in racing over rough roads and dirt roads and things like that. So to hear concerns over a little rough asphalt is kind of interesting. But but it is. It is a rougher surface than they're used to, and they're going to have to adjust and accommodate in the race.
I've never been a big NASCAR fan, but I understand I've seen the loyalty to NASCAR. It's like an all-star weekend, I guess, if you're a fan of some of these drivers.
Well, it has a loyal and passionate fan base. It's not probably the fan base that it was even 5-10 years ago. I think that their television ratings have gone down. There are fewer and fewer sellouts, which is one reason why NASCAR is excited about this race. It's a legitimate big-time crowd and sellout, which looks great on television. But honestly, even though interest may be down a little bit, it's still very high interest. I noticed the most watched program on cable TV last week was the NASCAR race from Daytona, and that's including, you know, beating out a lot of Casey Anthony, you know, murder trial coverage that was on cable. Now, there are some caveats to be had in there, but it shows that, you know, about 6 million people watched that race, and it's still a big draw.
So there's three races in this particular series?
Well, yeah, there's a truck race, and then a nationwide race, which is kind of the AAA to Sprint Cup's Major League, and that will be tonight. And then, of course, the Quaker State 400 is on Saturday, and that's the big race.
Are all the big names there this weekend that we've heard about over the years?
They are all here. NASCAR's biggest active names are all here. Jeff Gordon, Dale Earnhardt Jr., Jimmy Johnson, Carl Edwards, all the heavy hitters are here. Kyle Busch, who is, one of the hot names right now, actually won the race here last night. So all of the, if you're a NASCAR fan, this is it. This is the same group that ran down the Daytona 500 or in the Coca-Cola 600 is here in Kentucky, and they're going to be racing just like they do everywhere else.
Is there one name that sticks out, one really big name these days?
Well, it's funny, and I wrote about this a little bit too this week, but the biggest name in the sport is Dale Earnhardt Jr., but he has not been successful on the track. And I think that if NASCAR could wish one thing to happen, it would be for Earnhardt Jr. to win a race sometime this year. And, Kentucky, we've had some luck. We've had some historic names win in big standalone golf events here in the state, and NASCAR would like nothing better, I would say, than for Dale Earnhardt Jr. to win this inaugural race. It would be a huge thing for the sport. But he's the biggest name. He was the biggest earner on the NASCAR circuit last year, even though he wasn't anywhere close to the championship, and he's the biggest star. Now, the racers, Jimmy Johnson has won 5 straight points championships, and Jeff Gordon is always a big name, and there are plenty of big-name celebrity drivers, but his name is probably the biggest.
You mentioned Jeff Gordon. There was a bit of a backlash against Gordon for a while, wasn't there?
Well, that tends to happen to everybody that has a lot of success. And, of course, he went through a divorce. And, you don't know what all goes into these types of things. There was. Gordon has though, kind of weathered that. He's not a dominant driver anymore. Jimmy Johnson actually has won the last 5 points championships, something that's never been done at this level of NASCAR. He's won 5 in a row. He's in a hunt for number 6. He is a protege of Jeff Gordon, grew up in Southern California racing motorcycles. Jeff Gordon was a guy he patterned himself after. He has not experienced that same backlash that Gordon had, but that's something that tends to happen in NASCAR. If you win too much, people start to resent it, and Johnson wins again this year. I would suspect he might encounter it too.
You talked about the fans a little bit. I think some people have a preconceived stereotype of NASCAR fans being, Southern and that sort of thing, but it seems to cut across the demographic pretty well, doesn't it?
Yeah, the series did well among women sports fans. For a while, it was the most popular sport among women in the country. So there is a definite demographic for this. But you're right. You do get you get your corporate types that are fans, and really you never know. I'm amazed. It is a polarizing type of sport where people either tend to love it or just not care about it at all or hate it. But you never know where you're going to run into NASCAR fans. And I'm always surprised. There are settings where you think you might not see them, and they ask you, do you ever cover any NASCAR? Have you ever met this person? So it is interesting to see where they come from.
Well, what is the setup of the track like? Is there an infield area like we have at the Kentucky Derby?
Well, there is. Fans will not watch the race from there. One of the neat things about this speedway when it was built, and I assume that's still the case, even though they've added a lot of new seating, is that you can see the entire track all the way around from any seat in the house, which is not always the way at speedways. You know, at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you basically see the little section in front of you, and that's it. But there really isn't any infield seating. There's no infield bleacher seating or anything like that. Fans can get into the infield. The garages are all located in the infield, and they all open to the grandstand so that you can see into the garages from the grandstand. But you can get garage passes, and there are fans in the infield. They're just probably not too many in there watching the race.
And this is part of a correct me if I'm wrong, a year-long competition in which points are earned for each race won?
That's right. You know, they've tinkered with the points, you know, things to do. But what it all comes down to is they're racing to get in to finish the year in the top 10. And then once in the top 10, NASCAR has a series of events called the Chase, in which those 10 drivers go after each other, and the winner of that is the overall points champion. It's kind of like their version of the NCAA tournament. So they're all trying to position themselves right now to get into the Chase at the end of the year, and then the Chase determines the points champion.
How fast do these cars go?
Well, yesterday the fastest lap on the speedway turned was about 178 miles an hour. They will get up to speeds pretty high in competition on the straightaways, but I don't know, in competition I think you're not talking anywhere near a speed toward that, but the high qualifying speed is going to be around 180.
And this is not as fast as the open wheel cars that we see like at the Indianapolis 500.
No, the open wheel cars will approach 220, you know, on the, I don't know if they do 220 here at this speedway. Of course, the Indy cars race here and have raced here every year and have put on a great races here every year, and we'll be here back again in August for a night race. So, yeah, those cars, you know, 30, 40 miles per hour faster.
This is kind of a dumb question, but I'm sure the answer is yes. This is televised this weekend?
Yeah, it's a TNT telecast. The race is NASCAR has finished up a set of races on broadcast television, and now they've moved to cable, and it's a Turner production from here on out. Although they get a lot of coverage in the days leading up to the race from ESPN. ESPN has a live half-hour race show on every day that they've been broadcasting live from here too.
Now, are you up there for the whole weekend?
Yes, I'll be up here. I'm up here today, and then tomorrow I'll finally actually cover a race, and we'll get into it, and that'll be it. It'll be quick. And, you know, the state is, it's interesting, it's a big event. The state is not without these big events. It's not as many people as the Kentucky Derby. It's not as many viewers as the Kentucky Derby, but it's a different type of thing, and it'll be interesting to see how the Speedway plays on television and, you know, what kind of exposure the state gets for that, because as you mentioned, there's been an untold amount of time and money put into this place. And really, the Speedway itself is a marvel. It's basically just dug into the countryside here in the middle of nowhere. And I think just the fact that this event is here, given the improbability of it, is the biggest story of all this weekend.
All right, Eric Crawford with the Courier-Journal. Thanks for joining us from the Kentucky Speedway, Sparta, Kentucky, and nearby environs, and have a good weekend.
Thanks a lot.
All right, that's all the time we have for today's program. State of the News is produced by the WFPL News staff, which includes Gabe Bullard, Erica Peterson, Philip M. Bailey, Dalton Main, and Graham Shelby. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. For more information about the topics discussed today, visit WFPL.org. You can write to us at news@WFPL.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and our mailing address is 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. I'm Rick Howlett. Thanks for joining us. Have a good weekend.